In 2010, the largest oil spill in American history captivated the public's attention. Authorities told a story of a response effort that prevented a worst-case scenario. But if you ask some people who lived through the spill, they'll tell you a more complicated story.
They weren't attending to the workers.
I was bleeding from everywhere.
We were all lied to.
From Western Sound and APM Studios comes a new investigative podcast, Ripple, available now.
The Israeli army suffers its highest casualties since the war in Gaza began. I'm Carolyn Buehler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, as the ground offensive continues, Israel says the two-state solution is dead.
We're willing to a humanitarian temporary ceasefire, but the Israeli government does not support the two-state solution.
Also today, more migrants from Africa are crossing the southern border into the U.S.
I have almost 20 immigrants in my house. I help them, I feed them, teach them English. I help them to get job.
Plus, shifting global patterns of cocaine consumption.
And actor John Malkovich talks about directing a play in Latvian.
Auschwitz, or Auschwitz, as the Latvians say, is pretty clear in any language.
All that and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Buehler. Thousands of Palestinians are on the move again in the southern Gaza Strip. Today, people were leaving Khan Yunis, the second largest city, on trucks, donkey carts, and on foot, heading toward Rafah, farther south.
Gaza resident Ahmad Sharab told the Associated Press that this is the seventh time he's had to move on. Where am I supposed to go, he asked. We are more than 2 million people, all crowded into one small area. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who left their homes in the north were crowded into Khan Yunis, where the Israeli military is now conducting its most extensive ground operations in weeks.
Videos from the Israeli military show troops firing their weapons in the middle of heavily damaged buildings. Health officials in Gaza say nearly 200 Palestinians have been killed in the past day. Monday was also the deadliest day for the Israeli military since the start of the war. At least 21 soldiers were killed in one incident in Khan Yunis.
Through the months of fighting in Gaza, the U.S. and other countries have raised the two-state solution as the only way forward. But as the world's Matthew Bell reports, the Israeli government is pushing back against that idea.
Funerals were held today for some of the Israeli soldiers killed on Monday in Gaza. In a video statement, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said, "Yesterday was one of the most difficult days since the outbreak of the war." Netanyahu went on to say that Israelis will mourn the fallen, but we are not relenting even for a moment. There is no alternative other than total victory. But Israel is facing more pressure to work toward a ceasefire in the short term and in the longer term to revive the long-stalled plan for a two-state solution. The Biden administration has been saying this for weeks. The European Union is saying it. Even Saudi Arabia is signaling support for the idea.
The Israeli government does not support the two-state solution.
Earlier today, I spoke with Lior Hayat from Israel's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Hayat says Israel pursued that goal for many years, and the Palestinians rejected it by choosing violence instead. After the Hamas attack of October 7th, Hayat says Israel has no other choice but to defeat Hamas militarily and make sure that Gaza will no longer be a security threat.
We're willing to a humanitarian temporary ceasefire in order to release the hostages. We've done that before, but it does not mean that we will stop the war.
Intense military pressure, he says, is the only way to eliminate Hamas and force them to release the remaining hostages.
I don't agree. I think that there is no military way to defeat Hamas.
Nadav Tamir is a former Israeli diplomat based in Tel Aviv with the Peres Center for Peace and Innovation. Tamir says the deaths of 24 Israeli troops on Monday should be a wake-up call for the public in Israel.
I think the military campaign was justified, but it pretty much reached its limit, like every military campaign. I think people are starting to realize that there should be another way you know, and that we have to listen to everybody around us. Our Arab friends, our European friends are all saying the same.
There's plenty of skepticism about the two-state vision among Israelis, but David Makovsky of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy says now is the time to start talking about that vision.
The question is not should there be a state or not a state. The question is what sort of a state? If it's a state like Costa Rica, it would get universal support in Israel. And if it was a state like Iran, nobody will support it.
Palestinians have heard American presidents talk about a Middle East peace deal going back to Bill Clinton in the 1990s. Then George W. Bush talked about it. So did Barack Obama and Donald Trump. And now Joe Biden says the two-state solution is the only way to bring this conflict to an end. Mukaimer Abusada is a political scientist with Al-Azhar University in Gaza. He's now based in Cairo. And he says there's good reason for Palestinians to be cynical about the prospects of getting their own independent state someday.
There has to be some tools to try to put this idea into implementation, not just to mention the two-state solution. I think the U.S. has to show more seriousness with regard to putting enough pressure on Israel and Netanyahu or whoever is in the prime minister's office in Israel to the idea of a Palestinian state next to the state of Israel.
If that happens, Abusada says, most Palestinians will be responsive. But for now, he says their top priority is putting a stop to the bloodshed in Gaza. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Lagos is drowning in single-use plastic. Leaders of the Nigerian state, home to the country's largest city, say it clogs drainage channels daily. On Sunday, the state announced a new ban on the distribution and use of styrofoam and other single-use plastics, effective immediately. Speaking with CGTN Africa, Nigerian environmentalist Suleiman Arigbabu said the ban should have come years ago.
Now is the next best time for it to come. It is important that we all appreciate the hazards that plastic pollution brings upon all of us.
Many other cities and countries have preceded Lagos with bans of their own. To learn how effective they've been, we're turning to Pritish Bihuria. He studied plastic bans and is a senior lecturer at the University of Manchester in the UK.
Several bans like this have been implemented elsewhere. Announcing it is usually easier, but implementing it is the tough part.
So tell me more about that. What are some other countries or cities or states that have enacted similar bans? And do we know how well they have been working?
So actually, the Global South has taken much more stringent action towards plastic bag bans than countries in Europe or North America. I mean, Europe and North America have tended to take a more staged approach to this, like increasing taxes on using bags. And that often actually, within the academic literature, at least, it's seen to be more effective. These all-out bans most famously happened in Rwanda, which is, of course, a much smaller country than Nigeria. But it's also happened in Kenya, in Zambia, in Botswana. They've announced bans. Uganda has announced it, failed to implement it. Kenya itself also announced a ban three times and only implemented it about 4 or 5 years ago.
So that you're saying that the taxes on single-use plastic, the evidence shows those actually work better than outright bans?
Yeah, it's important because, of course, if you announce a ban, it gets a lot more public attention. And often that is one of the main drivers of why these bans are announced. So, of course, tackling drainage, tackling all sorts of environmental issues that plastic does cause is a driver of implementing these bans. But it's only part of the story, is that countries are announcing bans like these to increase their green credentials externally. And it helps them, not directly, but indirectly, promote themselves as environmental leaders, or at least acting in that sense, so they would gain more access to environmental bans. Of course, tackling plastic is part of the driver. I'm not saying that. But this is part of the broader story. And it's not clear if actually the bans are the best way to tackle the environmental issue.
Who is most impacted by bans on single-use plastic?
I think the biggest impact, and actually the most negative impact, is for people working in the informal sector. And that's a large chunk of the population. Not all of them are poor, but I think the poorest of them would find it the most difficult to not use that plastic anymore because it's so widespread and so easily available and often
easy to access. So it's actually quite negative in terms of being a redistributive policy. It's the opposite of that. I think a more gradual approach to this is probably a real better way of tackling the problem of plastic. There is one positive, perhaps, of announcing these all-out bans and implementation. It may be just a desperate measure to alert people to the attention of it and really like not implement it fully apart from a couple of days. So gradually the behaviors would change.
Do you expect that there will be more of these types of bans in the future?
Yeah, I think every country has been flirting with this. And I think the incentives are usually to announce the bans. And I think they've announced implementation, but usually there's a lot of backtracking after a few months. Especially in Nigeria and Lagos, it's incredibly difficult to see how this will be implemented too quickly. The closest example, I think, is Kenya and Nairobi. And Nairobi began announcing bans in the mid-2000s, and they went back on it at least 3 or 4 times before they actually did it very seriously, because they were falling behind on being a green leader on the continent.
Pritish Bihuria is with the Global Development Institute at the University of Manchester. He was explaining the results of banning plastic bags and single-use plastics, a policy that Lagos, Nigeria, is now also pursuing.
Last week, this news came over the airwaves on BBC Radio 1, the pop music station in the UK.
I'm really sorry to share with you that we've just heard the news now that Annie Nightingale has passed away.
Yeah. As Matt said, Annie was the first female broadcaster on Radio 1, and she really...
Annie Nightingale was the first woman DJ on the BBC and the broadcaster's longest-serving presenter. She was on the air for 5 decades. She reminisced on a BBC show about a year ago about her very first day on the job, which was not a slam dunk.
There was one record going round and round, and I'd only half learnt how to use the desk. And I thought, well, I must do something useful. So, that record's just going round and round, it's not doing anything, so I'll just press stop. It was the one that was being broadcast.
Annie Nightingale quickly proved herself, though, and remained with the BBC for the rest of her life. She was a critical source of support for artists from the Beatles to Duran Duran, as well as up-and-coming female artists and young women DJs. Her formula for what to spin was pretty simple. In a 2011 documentary about her life, A Bird on the Wireless, she said it was about sharing songs with someone she knows really well.
Being on the phone to your friend saying, I've heard this great tune, I'd love to play it to you. I want to play it down the phone to you. Have a listen, see what you think. You could be honest to yourself. I don't play anything I don't like.
4 years ago, Nightingale went on the legendary BBC's Desert Island Discs program and explained that over the years, her enthusiasm for new music never waned.
You get people saying, oh, it's all been done before, or that was a copy of something else, and people get very jaded. They lose that excitement of finding the freshness in new music, which somehow I seem to be able to hang on to.
On that episode of Desert Island Discs, Nightingale selected a track that underscored her lifelong excitement for new trends and sounds.
I've witnessed changes in music which have been incredibly exciting. And one of the biggest step changes ever was rap and how that took over America and the world and has brought about people who become so important, like Beyoncé.
Annie Nightingale broadcast her final show on BBC Radio 1 just this past December. She died last week at the age of 83. I'ma keep on running cause the winner don't quit on themselves.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Each month, about 50 countries that are Ukraine's allies have been meeting to discuss Ukraine's military strategy against Russia. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin started those rendezvous in April 2 years ago. Today was the first meeting where the U.S. was out of money for Ukraine and unable to send ammunition and missiles to fight against Russia's invasion and occupation. So the U.S. is counting on other allies to keep the funding pipeline open to Ukraine. Austin addressed the meeting on Zoom from his home.
So I urge this group to dig deep, to provide Ukraine with more life-saving ground-based air defense systems and interceptors.
Meanwhile, today, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg announced a new contract for 155-millimeter shells, tank-busting ammunition heavily used by Ukraine in the war. That NATO contract is worth more than $1 billion and will be used to supply allies who have pushed their own reserves to Kyiv. In the U.S., more than $110 billion in aid for both Ukraine and Israel is stalled in Washington as Congress feuds over domestic issues, including border security.
For decades, writers have grappled with the evil of the Holocaust. British playwright Tom Stoppard, for example, took it on in his highly acclaimed play Leopoldstadt. The production traces the declining fortunes of a Jewish family in Vienna during that period. In 2023, it won a number of Tony Awards, including for Best Play. Now there's a new production of Leopoldstadt making headlines in Riga, Latvia, in part because of who is directing it. The World's Daniel Offman reports.
Leopoldstadt is set in Vienna, Austria, and follows one Jewish family through the first half of the 20th century. They start off well-to-do and strongly assimilated into Austrian culture. But over time, they lose almost everything. Over five acts, the play jumps ahead in time. World War I sweeps through Europe, the Austro-Hungarian Empire falls, the Nazis take over Austria, and the Holocaust ravages European Jewry. The family suffers through this dark history, and few survive.
It's a very important topic for a play. It seems to be a topic that never goes away.
That's John Malkovich. Yes, the John Malkovich. He's directing the Latvian production of Leopoldstadt at the Dialis Theater in Riga. Malkovich had previously performed there as an actor, and he was invited to return as a director. He chose to put on Leopoldstadt because of his fascination with Viennese history.
Viennese Jewry was a very important part of the makeup of Vienna. And even with all the assimilation which happened, we still had quite a terrible result.
For playwright Tom Stoppard, Leopoldstadt is considered his most personal work.
I've shed more tears over watching Leopoldstadt than the rest of my work put together.
Stoppard was interviewed about the play on the PBS NewsHour. He comes from a Jewish family that fled Czechoslovakia to escape the Nazis in 1938. Most of Stoppard's extended family was killed in the Holocaust, including his four grandparents. For Malkovich, the play was a vehicle for exploring themes such as identity and assimilation, but also human cruelty.
Human behavior and the things people can do to other people are always fascinating and sometimes highly alarming. But it doesn't take a Holocaust for it to be alarming. It can be alarming in everyday life by millions of little cruelties.
Leopoldstadt isn't a simple play to direct. The subject matter is heavy, and it's an ambitious production with a sprawling cast. And for Malkovich, the language adds another layer of difficulty, since the play is being performed in Latvian.
So my name is Diana Kajaka, and I'm the assistant director of this performance.
Kajaka worked closely with Malkovich throughout the audition and rehearsal process. She helped bridge the language gap.
I did my best to help with translations in the rehearsal room, and we used these screens where we had the text, Latvian and English, side by side, so John could follow it, so he could constantly look at the actors, and just in his peripheral vision, he would see those screens.
Gajica says that Malkovich would listen to the actors almost like a music conductor. She says he was quick to pick up some Latvian words. But overall, Malkovich says he wasn't really concerned about the language barrier.
Language is not really a factor in something like this because they're human messages. Auschwitz, or Auschwitz, as the Latvians say, is pretty clear in any language.
Malkovich says that as a director, there's something he's looking for in a performance that's hard to pinpoint.
The thing you're listening for is truth, and that's beyond language, I think. It's about how a character expresses their view of the world.
One example that Malkovich mentions is a scene from the first act of the play. Two characters, Herman and Ludwig, debate the topic of assimilation. Herman describes the heights that Jews have reached in Vienna because of their assimilation. In other words, losing the characteristics that made them Jewish. Ludwig's character responds.
Assimilācija nozīmē, ka tu vari būt tas, kas tu esi, un neciest par to.
He says assimilation doesn't mean to stop being a Jew. Assimilation means that you can be who you are and not suffer for it. Carlos Arnolds Avots plays Ludwig in this Latvian production. He says being directed by John Malkovich was a big deal.
I think that the biggest difference when you compare him to other directors that he doesn't have this unhealthy ambition, I would say, or he don't have to prove anything for us, you know, and it was quite easy in a healthy and a creative way.
Arnolds Avots says that he was motivated by Malkovich's presence, but his performance didn't come from a desire to impress the famous actor. It came from a more personal place.
We Latvians, we had a lot of deportations in our history and occupations and stuff like that. And for example, my grand-grandfather, Carlis Alfreds Avots, he died in Siberia. So you have to always make it personal. In a way, and that was my approach for making it personal.
At the end of the play, about a decade after the Holocaust, three of the surviving cousins meet up at the now empty familial home in Vienna. One of them, an Englishman named Leo, is a stand-in for Tom Stoppard. Leo barely remembers his family history, and he doesn't show much interest or compassion. One of his cousins rebukes him and says, "You live as if without history. As if you throw no shadow behind you." Stoppard has said that writing Leopoldstadt is that shadow catching up with him. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman, Riga, Latvia.
More global news and stories are still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World.
The UN says up to 15,000 people were killed last year in one city in the ongoing civil war in Sudan's Darfur region. Many Sudanese have experienced such violence before.
Just to witness some of the atrocities back in 2003 and to see the same thing occurs once again in 2023, it is terrible.
The pass in Darfur makes a disturbing return, still ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Global production of cocaine has doubled since 2010, according to the UN. There are new trade routes, a rise in drug cartel violence along those routes, including in Ecuador, which has seen a surge in that violence recently. And there are changes in where cocaine is being consumed. Brian Winter is editor-in-chief of America's Quarterly. He says one region where cocaine use is on the rise is in Latin America.
Today, Latin America and the Caribbean account for about 25% of the world's cocaine users, according to the United Nations. And that's behind only North America, which accounts for about 30%. And it puts Latin America and the Caribbean on the same level as Europe. Africa and Asia are also seeing increases. So we've really seen a pretty significant change over the last 10, 15 years or so in where cocaine goes.
So has this increase in Latin America been slow and steady rise, or has there been something that's really driven demand recently?
There's a couple factors here. One of them is, you know, you have to be careful what you wish for. The first part of the 2010s was a good time in Latin America when economies were growing in part because of demand for the region's commodities from China. And so middle classes grew by millions of people in places like Brazil, as well as in Peru, Chile, Colombia, and elsewhere. Once more people had money in their pockets, they decided to spend more of it on not only goods like refrigerators and cars, but recreational use of illicit drugs, including cocaine. The other big trend is just this huge increase in the amount of cocaine being produced. And it's very clear that that has resulted in more availability of cocaine in the countries where it's passing through on its way to other markets.
So it is both an increase in income that is giving more people in Latin America more money to buy this, and then also just a flooding of supply.
It's demand, it's supply. And then there's the more recent trend, of course, which is the pandemic. We saw all over the world that when people were isolated, when they were off their jobs, we saw this in the United States as well, but it seems to have been borne out in several Latin American countries that people turn to drugs and alcohol and other substances.
And I understand that in Latin America, Brazil is really the driver of this trend. Can you explain why?
Well, Brazil's big. This sure. is a country of more than 205 million people by several estimates, according to the United Nations. Brazil is now the number two country for cocaine consumption globally. But it's actually not the region's biggest on a per capita basis, on a per person basis. The biggest, most popular countries for cocaine use in the region are Uruguay, Argentina, and Chile. You know, here again, those are three of the wealthiest countries in the region, and where cocaine is in many cases being trafficked through on its way to Europe. Increasingly, we're seeing that it tends to stay, at least some of it, in some of these transit countries.
So who are the biggest users in these countries? Are they rich people, poor folks, a combination of both?
Well, I think we see a little bit of everything. Brazil is a country with one of the world's biggest gaps between rich and poor, but it appears that use of cocaine is pretty democratic. Of course, the poorer parts of the population, you see more usage of crack there. And there are more seizures of crack than pure cocaine in Brazil, but that repeats patterns that we see here in the United States as well. You know, essentially, rich people with their party drugs are mostly left alone. Law enforcement tends to focus at the street level in poorer neighborhoods.
I want to ask specifically about those new drug trade routes. Is that also a primary driver of increased usage?
Well, I think the experts on global drug flows are still trying to figure this out because there are some changes happening right now. And one of the drivers is, unfortunately, the popularity of fentanyl in the United States, which, of course, now accounts for the vast majority of our overdose deaths here. And with fentanyl increasingly flowing north from Mexico into the United States, what we see is cocaine, more of it is flowing south, west, and east to Europe, to Asia, and of course, within the region itself. So that's been a big change over the last couple of years.
Brian Winter is a Latin America analyst and editor-in-chief of America's Quarterly. He was explaining changes in who is consuming cocaine that's produced in South America.
A few updates for you now on stories we've reported recently.
Sweden is a step closer to joining NATO, but not quite there yet. Turkey and Hungary have been the outliers resisting Sweden's membership. Late today, Turkey's parliament gave Sweden the thumbs up. And also today, the prime minister of Hungary invited his Swedish counterpart over for talks.
An Italian soccer club has put a lifetime ban on a fan who racially abused a black player during a weekend match. As we reported yesterday, the incident is one among many that has led to widespread calls for professional soccer to address racism in the game.
And do you remember hearing about Benito, the lonely giraffe? He's been moved to a new home in an animal park in central Mexico with seven other giraffes to hang out with. Benito had been all alone in a city park in Ciudad Juarez, to the dismay of animal advocates and concerned members of the public.
Find all the stories you might have missed from us on our website, that's theworld.org, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Many of the migrants trying to enter the United States via the southern border started their journey on the African continent. They fly through countries in West Africa and Europe to get to Central America, where they then continue traveling overland. The World's Tibisay Seya reports on why people from various countries in Africa increasingly see the U.S. as an attractive destination.
In the past 6 months, Omar Bal's house in Cincinnati has turned into a shelter for immigrants from Mauritania.
I have almost 20 immigrants in my house. Some stayed almost like 6-7 months. They live in my house. I help them, I feed them, teach them English. I help them to get job. We have group community over here.
There are about 8,000 Mauritanians in the U.S., and half of them live in Ohio. Bal left Mauritania for Cincinnati back in 1997, and he says he's never seen so many Mauritanians arriving at once.
Right now, I can help people. That's what I do. Because time I need help, someone help me. It's time to pay back.
Migrants from African countries still represent a very small fraction of the people crossing the U.S. southern border. The vast majority come from Latin America and the Caribbean. But last year, four times as many Africans were detained at the U.S.-Mexico border compared to 2022. That's according to data from Customs and Border Protection. There is a combination of factors driving more Africans to the U.S. One important reason is that there is a new route via Nicaragua. This Central American nation has few visa requirements for citizens of several African countries, and the route is now being promoted on social media.
I say all people coming in 2023, living in my house, pass by Nicaragua.
Omar Bal says the migrants landed in Nicaragua after flying through Morocco, Turkey, and Spain. In the past, African migrants headed to the U.S. had to fly to Brazil first and then trek through the dense jungle of the Darien Gap. Flying to Nicaragua allows people to skip that dangerous part of their journey. And once they get to the U.S.-Mexico border, the chances of being admitted are very high, says Muzaffar Chishti. He's with the Migration Policy Institute.
And then if you apply for asylum, you won't get a hearing for years. And during that time, you can work legally. And the chance of being removed, even if your asylum application is denied, are very low. So those are really very important pull factors.
He says it's extremely difficult to deport people to Africa because the U.S. doesn't have deportation agreements with African nations. Across the Atlantic, immigration policies in Europe have become more restrictive, says Camille Lecoz. She's with the Migration Policy Institute in Europe.
There is increased efforts from European to work with different countries in Africa to prevent people from coming. And in turn, this has made journeys more expensive, but also more dangerous.
More than 2,000 people have died or gone missing in the Central Mediterranean in 2023, the deadliest year since 2017. That's why some African migrants who can afford it might decide to take route by air, Lecoz says. A lot of Africans are escaping from dire situations at home.
What is also clear is that the economies have really suffered from the pandemic. And now, you know, with inflation, price of energy, like, and, you know, part of this continent being at war, this is also having an impact. And you had the effect of climate change on livelihood.
Mauritania is at the top of the list of African nationalities coming to the U.S.-Mexico border. 15,000 Mauritanians were detained last year. Senegal follows with 13,000 migrants, and Guinea with about 4,000. Each of these countries faces a different set of challenges. In the case of Mauritania, racial tensions have increased in recent months, says Omar Bal.
I know how these people suffering in my own country. They run away from slavery and discrimination.
Mauritania was one of the last countries to criminalize slavery, and the practice still persists. Several Mauritanians who spoke to the World said police are persecuting them because of their anti-slavery activism. One of them is Nadiru Tambatu. He's living in Omar Bal's house in Cincinnati. He's been fighting for racial justice and was targeted by Arab authorities in Mauritania, he says. I left my country because my life is in danger, he says. They treat black people like slaves and they kill you if you don't like their system, he says. Tambatu is hoping not to experience discrimination in the U.S. So far, he feels safe and accepted in his new community in Ohio. For the world, I'm Tivisa Isaiah.
More than 7.5 million people have fled Venezuela in the past 8 years, escaping violence and instability. In the past year alone, tens of thousands of Venezuelans have settled just in Colorado. Many arrived there by bus from border states. Aspen Public Radio has been collecting their stories of migration. One of them is Asdrubal Alvarado, who described his life in Venezuela and why he decided to come to the U.S.
Yo vivía en un estado que se llama Acuarico, que es calabozo. Vivía con mi familia, mi madre, mi padre, mi hermana.
I used to live in a place called Guarico in Calabozo. I lived with my family, my parents, my mom, my dad, my siblings. The most beautiful thing for me was my childhood, you know, in the country because I love horses. Since I can remember, I've been riding them. On Sundays when we were little, we would get together and we would go to run the horses. And then whoever would win would be so happy. You know, it was like this joy that made you feel like the best child around. And then I went to university, to military school, and I was 16. After I graduated, that's when the situation in my country changed. I had a job as a supervisor, and there were a lot of threats about death from higher-ups. So I decided that it was for my well-being and for my family that I had to leave and come here to look for better opportunities, for a better life.
Yo salí el 14 de febrero de este año y la meta era llegar a Estados Unidos porque aquí no tengo quien me recibiera ni tengo familia.
I left February 14th this year, and the goal was to get to the United States, but I didn't have anyone here to receive me. I don't have any family. God was the only one that was with me. It's not an easy trip because you have to go through 6 or 7 countries. Colombia, Panama, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico. The only part where you cannot communicate with your family is when you get to Panama, going through the jungle, you know, because there's nothing there, nothing at all. That's the ugliest part, that jungle. And you learn a lot of things, you know, survival, because there are some days that you have something to eat, and there's some that you don't have enough money to eat that day. You have to sleep outside, you know, underwater.
Yo salí solo, pero uno en el camino y en la selva, pues, que uno ahí aprende a compartir, a ser amable, de si te regalan un pan, de ese pan comemos todo.
I left alone, but along the way and in the jungle, you learn to share, you learn to be kind. If someone gives you a piece of bread, from that piece of bread, everybody will eat. Sometimes I don't have a blanket and he has a blanket, and he gives me a piece of it. There's a lot of things that you learn on that trip, because it's not easy at all. We were able to make it together. The group that I was in, the day that we showed up, we were sent to immigration, and I was like, my God, I was never in jail in my country, and now I'm here, and now I'm going to a prison, an immigration prison. It was 3 months in New Mexico, but after the 3 months, there's more opportunities. They gave us an ID number and a piece of paper, with which we can be here. We had to find an attorney so they can help us process, but we can't get a job so that we can pay the attorney. How are we going to get that money for the process?
Trabajamos 5 días en el paso, completamos el pasaje para Denver y nos vinimos. Lo que llegamos a Denver nos dijeron que ahí estaba ese refugio y buscamos trabajo en el Hundipo.
We worked 5 days in El Paso. We had enough money to buy the ticket to get to Denver. And when we got there, they told us about the shelter, and then we tried to find some work. But then they gave us 12 days at the shelter and then kicked us out. The 6 that were together, you know, we went through the same process with immigration, and we are here. My companion and I decided to go towards the mountains to this town, and it's been okay. They've opened the doors for us. We're very grateful for this town because we've had people show up to help us to share something. What do you need? How can we help you? We're not here, you know, to be a burden. We're not here to hurt anyone. We are here with faith to move forward in our lives.
La mayor esperanza es que podamos conseguir un trabajo y que estemos estables. Si hemos trabajado un día, dos días, tres días, hay personas que nos vienen, nos buscan. Muchachos, los necesito una hora, dos horas, tres horas.
My biggest hope is that we can find jobs and that we can all just be stable. We've worked a day, 2 days, 3 days. There's people that come and find us and they're like, here, come. I need you for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. Roofing, gardening, and then construction help. If God would allow it one day, maybe I can have my own company for, you know, yard maintenance.
Si llego a conseguir un trabajo en un rancho, fuera feliz. Llevo la sangre caballo por mis venas.
If I'm able to work on a ranch, I would be happy. It's in my blood, in my veins, and hopefully one day, God willing, I'll be able to have a bunch of horses, my own horses. Back in Venezuela, my child who's 4, he has a horse. He's just like his dad.
No es fácil dejar sus raíces, sus costumbres, a la madre, sus hijos. Venirse a un país donde no conoces a nadie, que eres forastero.
It's not easy to leave your roots and to just pick up and leave your mother, your children. To leave to a place where you don't know anyone, where you're a stranger. You have to adapt yourself and, you know, keep fighting for your dreams.
Y luchar por lo que uno quiere, por su sueño.
That was Asdrubal Alvarado, who now lives outside of Denver, Colorado. He told his story to Aspen Public Radio's Eleanor Bennett. The series was produced with help from the Public Media Journalists Editor Corps.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Buehler. Just a couple of years ago, Sudan appeared poised to enter a new chapter in its history. Activists had toppled the country's longtime dictator. A transitional government pointed to a future with democratic rule. But last April, that process came to a screeching halt when a paramilitary force known as the Rapid Support Forces went to war with Sudan's army.
Today, fighting rages throughout Sudan with some of the worst violence in the western Darfur region. A new UN report estimates up to 15,000 people were killed last year in one single city in Darfur. Mutasim Ali is a legal advisor for the Raoul Wallenberg Center for Human Rights in Montreal. Mutasim grew up in Darfur and has extended family still trapped there.
Right now, with the extended family in North Darfur, you know, I haven't been able to establish contacts with them for a little more than 2 months. Right now, a lot of people are forced to leave, and others who remained are compelled to pay money for, quote unquote, their protection. And if they fail to pay the money, they would be attacked and killed by the RSF.
UN monitors just released this report describing current atrocities in the Darfur town of El Geneino. What happened to residents there as they tried to flee across the border to Chad?
West Darfur, El Geneino, is one example of many other cities in Darfur that are targeted by the Rapid Support Forces and its allied Arab militias, right? They systematically target non-Arab tribes. They execute men, they rape women, and they force people to flee, and they destroy homes, and they want to obliterate the African culture and tradition in Darfur. You know, people are being attacked systematically on ethnic grounds.
Now, the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces, they need support to wage their war against the National Army and to continue to stage attacks in Darfur. How do the UN monitors who released this report, how do they describe the role played by the United Arab Emirates in this conflict?
Let's be clear. First, the RSF is primarily trained and equipped by the Sudanese armed forces, right? Before their fallout, right? They got all their training and military equipment from the Sudanese armed forces.
That doesn't continue, though, presumably.
That doesn't continue right now because of the fallout. But now the RSF is getting a lot of support, right? From the gold reserve that they possess, right? They used to invest a lot in gold mining. And, of course, there are many regional actors involved in supporting the RSF. And the UN report clearly revealed the role of the UAE, even though the UAE is denying the allegations. But I think there is quite substantial evidence to say that the UAE, and of course not the UAE alone, involved in supporting the RSF, of course, not only to carry out hostile activities against the Sudanese armed forces, but primarily against civilian populations in Darfur, right? And therefore, I can say without hesitation that the UAE, based on the UN report, and of course, other regional actors such as Chad, could be complicit in breaches of Genocide Convention for failing to prevent and stop commission of likely genocidal acts in Darfur.
I'm speaking with Mutasim Ali, a legal advisor for the Raoul Wallenberg Center for Human Rights. The Rapid Support Forces, as you obviously know, is headed by General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, or Hemeti as he's known. He's been on something of a media blitz recently, traveling throughout Africa, staging photo ops with smiling dignitaries, including the leaders of South Africa and Kenya. Are Darfur residents seeing those pictures?
Sadly, people are seeing these pictures and are really very painful, especially for those who just recently fled, you know, atrocities in West Darfur, right, who are now in eastern Chad and refugee camps, right, seeing their alleged perpetrator, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, visiting many African states and being welcomed. So this is really shameful.
Why are these African leaders essentially legitimizing a warlord linked to atrocities in Darfur, Mutasim?
I would say follow the money. I think that's the only justification I have for this. Because the RSF is heavily investing in gold, and they have numerous companies, as the UN report disclosed, about 50 companies, right, that are supporting the RSF. And so I'm worried that some of the African leaders are involved in this scheme as well.
Darfur is experiencing what some are calling a second round of genocide, Mutasim. The first was in the early 2000s, of course. You were there, right, at that time. Can you tell us what you experienced?
My family and I used to live in a village, a very small, beautiful village in East Jabal Marra. This is in northern Sudan, north Darfur. And the Janjaweed in 2004 attacked our village, and that's when my family and I separated, right? Dozens of people have been killed in the village, and we just left them behind.
How old were you at the time?
That attack was multiple times, but when I was forced to leave and separate from my family, I was 16.
What did those attacks look like?
You cannot imagine that a human being would do similar attacks. Before they attacked, the Janjaweed would attack a village, my village at the time. They would loot. They would come and pillage and loot everything. Then next, they will burn houses, and then whoever is seeking to flee will be shot, right? Solely because they are non-Arabs. And so it was terrible just to witness some of the atrocities back in 2003 and to see the same thing occurs once again in 2023. It is terrible.
Mutasim, I sense your concern that there will be impunity again for the atrocities in Darfur while this war between the National Army and the RSF grinds on. What should the international community be doing this time around?
This is really very, very painful. I mean, a lot of people, especially in Darfur, they began to lose faith in the international community, right? But I do think that there is much that the international community can do. There are tools, right? Perpetrators who continue to commit atrocities, such as Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo and the senior commanders of the RSF, must be held to account. There are, you know, numerous mechanisms. The ICC, they could try individuals, there are regional mechanisms, even targeted sanctions, right? They must be signaled and they must be ashamed and they must be made international employers. This is one. And two, there are mechanisms to hold companies or even states to account. For example, if countries are found to be complicit in the breaches of the Genocide Convention, right, in this case, the UAE, based on the UN report, right, and Chad and perhaps other countries, they should be held to account for their complicit in the atrocities committed in Darfur.
Mutasim Ali is a legal advisor for the Raoul Wallenberg Center for Human Rights. Mutasim, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco. Appreciate it.
That is our show for you on this Tuesday. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I am Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Join us again right back here tomorrow.